Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. Today I am in dialogue with Gennady Estreich and Harriet Morav. They are the editors of the book, Soviet Jews in World War II, Fighting, Witnessing, Remembering, published in Boston by Academic Studies Press 2014. Gennady Estreich is professor at the Skirball Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at New York University. Harriet Morav is a Center for Advanced Study professor at the University of Illinois. She is also Catherine and Bruce Bastien Professor of Global and Transnational Studies at the University of Illinois. She is also a member of the University of Illinois' Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures and Department of Comparative and World Literature. She is the interim director of the Center for Comparative and World Literature also at the University of Illinois. Harriet and Gennady, it is an honor to be with you today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To begin, can you kindly tell us about yourselves? If you don't mind me asking, where did you grow up? What formative events in your lives inspired the scholars you are today?
I grew up in New Jersey, but I wouldn't say that growing up in New Jersey was a formative event in my life as a scholar. A formative event in my life as a scholar was falling in love with the Russian language at a very early age, and then over the course of time, developing an argument against those who said there was no Jewish culture in the Soviet Union after the 1930s. And this book and many other books that I've written are all about that argument, that Soviet Jews were soldiers, they were witnesses, they were victims, they conducted memorial activities in the immediate aftermath of events that took place near their homes, and that Jewish culture was not a washout in the Soviet Union. That is a product of Cold War cultural animosity between the USSR and the United States. And we're still sort of creeping out from under that. But it's not so much a formative event in my life as a formative argument in my life as a scholar that brought me to the point where, you know, talking with Gennady, and there's no book on the Soviet Jewish war experience. Let's do something. And it was a meeting of the minds.
My beginning is somewhere in Ukraine. Yes. I know exactly where. Yes, it is in a city in Ukraine. And I was privileged to be born, and I grew up in a Yiddish-speaking family. Yes, my father was a historian, a teacher of history before the war at Yiddish schools, and after the war, Ukrainian and Russian schools. Yeah. So Yiddish became my one of my first languages. Yes, and afterwards, for some years I was in Moscow. And I was managing editor of a Yiddish literary journal that was published in Moscow. And later I moved to Oxford here, where I did my doctoral studies and so on. And eventually 21 years ago, I ended up at New York University. So concerning the theme of the book, I grew up surrounded by actually officers, veterans of the Second World War. My father was an officer, my uncles, all of them were officers here, and all of them came, yes. And then some of them didn't come. Yeah, I also have such uncles and other relatives who didn't come. So I grew up listening to their stories, and not only their stories, of course, about fighting, but in general, the Holocaust-related stories here. Yeah. So this is a very important topic for me personally as well, yes. Not only academically, but also personally. And sometimes I get even emotional when it comes to this topic. And I just finished writing an article for a Yad Vashem publication on Jewish officers in the Red Army. So I continue from time to time, though it's not By far not the main avenue in my research here, but still I come back every time.
There are many people you thank in your acknowledgments. Would you like to express gratitude to anyone publicly?
I don't remember.
Acknowledgements. I don't know how many.
I, first of all, want to acknowledge Harriet. Without you, this book would have...
I want to acknowledge Gennady, yes. Also, without yes. whom... You know, we actually thanked the U.S. Holocaust Museum and the NYU Department of Russian Studies. I mean, I'm not sure that we actually, to our shame, thanked that many... people, but I would like to acknowledge that we have lost people who are very prominent in the study of Soviet Jews. People, Mordechai Altshuler is no longer with us. David Schneer is no longer with us, and I'd like to acknowledge them.
Yes, and of course also the person who triggered the whole exercise. A professor at our university, for sure, I don't remember even his name, it was so many years ago, who came to our department with this idea, you have to organize a conference, because before the volume, there was a conference that finally led to the publication, preparation publication of the volume. Yeah.
What are the primary themes in this book? What message or messages does your book convey?
Well, the primary themes of the book are the histories of Soviet Jews as soldiers and their representation of the war effort in the Soviet and the Soviet Jewish press. And then we have a section on representation, documentation, and interpretation in which we looked at poetry, cinema, photojournalism that directly represented, imagined, and described events of the Holocaust as they unfolded on Soviet soil. And then the last section is memoirs by prominent figures, Soviet Jewish figures, who served in World War II. One of them, for example, Buddy Slutsky, a wonderful, wonderful poet who was also a procurator and was responsible for army discipline and did not publish in his lifetime, but published later his account, his memoirs of being in the Soviet army as a Jew.
There's also an underlying topic that I don't believe we spelled it out at that time. But actually, during the Second World War, over 400,000 Jews were in the army. Not necessarily during the entire period. Someone was just one day and killed on this first day, and so on. Yeah. Someone were young in 1941, but were not so young, were of this age, when they could join the army in 1943, 1944, and so on. So we're speaking about hundreds of thousands of people who, those who survived, who came after the war back. Some of them stayed in the army, but the majority of them returned to civil life. And they played an incredibly important role in Soviet Jewish life after the Second World War, because they came as veterans of the war. Many of them were members of the Communist Party. Many of them were educated or had a chance to be educated after the war. And they formed, shaped a group in a category even in the Soviet Jewry that they formed a kind of a core of the Soviet Jewry after the Second World War. Because given the fact they were veterans, that they were educated, that they were members of the Communist Party, it meant that there were people who could, and in many cases would, be promoted would be appointed to various important, whatever the importance is, could be local importance, it could be regional importance, sometimes it was national importance of positions. And some of them became household names, as Harriet mentioned, Boris Lutsky, a poet, and then there were many other writers who, as young people, were soldiers and officers in the army, musicians, artists, and scholars, and so on. So we're picking, actually, the book is essentially about a very important segment of the Jewish population in the Soviet Union.
This book came out in 2014. It is now 2023. Has your thinking on this topic changed in any way since the book came out? Why or why not? Have you reflected in any new or different ways? Have you learned anything new? Has any feedback changed your perspective?
Definitely. New archival material, new things written and published. So it was, I can't think that it changed the strategy, yes, but it in thinking about it, but the amount of information today is different, more details, more information, more not only primary colors but something in between various hues, yeah, and of course it is different.
I would say the war against Ukraine makes the actual factual engagement with what the Soviet Jewish experience was, what the Holocaust was, all the more important to put before the general reader that Ukraine was not the enemy in World War II. Ukraine was not the Nazis. The Nazis were the Nazis. And Jews today, Ukrainian Jews, are fighting the war, as for example, in the person of the president, you know. So given the tremendous distortion of history and the loss of historical memory, I think it's just sort of deepened my sense that it's very important to get the story out of who was fighting whom and who was doing what in World War II. In subsequent work that I've been involved with, it just feels all the more urgent given the incredibly divisive, hateful propaganda that Putin is using about, you know, Ukrainians crucifying children, which is something Jews used to be accused of, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And in a sense, it is still this issue that it started during the Second World War, that Jews were underrepresented in the army and so on. And it is still, you know, so many decades after this, some people continue to repeat the same story. Jews didn't fight. Jews were during the Second World War somewhere in Tashkent, in Central Asia, rather than at the front line. So it is important to not just to argue, but to argue being equipped with figures, with facts, with the research, and so on. And luckily, nowadays we have better access to archives and a lot of publications. Once more, a lot of publications and also an enormous number of interviews collected, interviews with the veterans, Jewish veterans of the war. So all this helps.
What is your book's contribution to the historiography of Soviet Jewry?
Well, one, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews fighting in the Soviet army. Two, Jews were not only aware of the Nazi genocide and victims of it, they remembered their brethren and sisters who were murdered, you know, for decades. Its picture has changed, but, you know, there were no monuments at Babi Yar. That was kind of the line at the West. The Soviets didn't memorialize. There is no memory. And I think one big section of the book shows that writers who were officers and wrote directly about the Soviet, the victimage, the genocide at the time, and it was well known. I mean, I think we forget that the Soviet Union was the main instigator of the Nuremberg trials. So those those are contributions, I think, that the book makes to the historiography that still need to be made, even though the story is somewhat different, as Gennady keeps rightly pointing out. We have new materials, new publications, new interviews. We're still making that argument. One, Jews fought. Two, Jews remembered and memorialized.
Yeah. Can you describe the different genres of artistic expression that Jews utilized in the Soviet Union? Can you tell us about the similarities and differences between Soviet Jewish photography, Soviet Jewish film, Soviet Jewish television, and Soviet Jewish literature and poetry? How did the different media of art impact the kinds of themes, motifs, and messages communicated?
It's important to start from that there was no Jewish television in the Soviet Union. There were no Jewish films. And strictly speaking, it is also a question how to define what is Jewish literature, what is literature written by Jews in other languages, so non-Jewish languages. So it is a question of definitions, yes, clearly there is no one definition. There are at least two definitions here. But certainly, what is important that mainly it was written, it was staged, and so on, performed in the framework that was not Jewish. It could be by Jews, and in many cases it was by Jews, but it was not a Jewish film. It was not a Jewish organization. It was not a Jewish newspaper, because Jewish newspapers or Jewish journals or publications, it was in the Soviet Union, it meant in Yiddish or something translated from Yiddish into Russian, Ukrainian, or some other languages, but it was minor. The mainstream was in different languages, in other languages, mainly in Russian, in Ukrainian, and other. So it creates a different picture, and it creates a different pattern of the representation of Jewish topics, of Jewish arguments, and so on, in the Soviet Union and in the countries of the West, in the United States or elsewhere. Because in the United States, for example, there's the Jewish press, there's the Jewish organizations, and so on and so forth. Yes, so in the Soviet Union, it hardly existed, and the result is, of course, that it was quite different.
We do have Einikeit. We do have other publications, and some of the most well-known and important pieces of writing that circulated in the Soviet Union in Russian at the time were written by, you know, Ilya Ehrenberg was the chief architect of propaganda, and he did talk about the Nazi murder of Jews. The very famous The Oath by Itzhak Pfeffer, which appeared in Russian translation the same year that it was published in Yiddish, was extremely well known and well promulgated. Stories that were published in Russian, for example, by Vasily Grossman, The Old School Teacher, which is actually lays out a Nazi plan to exterminate Jews and how you separate children from adults. That was published in Russian. It certainly, anyone reading it would consider it Jewish. There are many other examples. Ilya Sivinsky's I Saw It, about the massacre of Jews in outside of Kerch, and his poetry about trials of collaborators. I mean, so remember, the Soviet Union actually wanted to look like the defender of Jews in this period of World War II. You know, the government created the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, whose organ was Einikeit, and so forth. There were films, there was photojournalism, and it requires reading it in a certain way. After all, when I went to school in the United States, the Holocaust was one very skinny paragraph in history books. It was not, you did not talk about the Holocaust in public school. There was no requirement to discuss it. There was no attention given it. So, I mean, millions of people not in the Soviet Union did not know about what was going on because the information was, in fact, suppressed. That's another perspective.
Yeah, but and maybe it is also worthwhile to mention that there's a separate corpus of literature, and not only literature, but first of all, literature written, Holocaust-related literature written by non-Jews in various languages, in Russian, in Ukrainian. Recently, I was sitting at the Holocaust Museum in Washington and listening to presentations on literature written in Lithuanian by Lithuanian writers, and so on. Even you know, there's a prominent poem written by Itzik Pfeffer, character already mentioned a couple of times his name here, because he's one of the central figures in Yiddish literature at that time. Yeah, and he wrote this prominent poem. I am a Jew. I am a Jew. It was really, and he came to the United States with this poem and read it first. But actually, the first poet who wrote "I am a Jew," and my guess is that maybe Pfeffer, in a sense, modeled his. It was an Uzbek poet. An Uzbek poet, you know, his reaction to the Holocaust was that "I am a Jew as well." Yeah, and then so on. So you can find a very interesting piece sort of artistic expressions. Yeah.
What kinds of diaries are examined in your book? Who wrote them? What do they teach us about diaries as a source of history?
Diaries, it's in general very important, because the main specialist, when it comes to diaries, the main specialist diaries of the time of the Second World War, it's Professor Oleg Budnitsky. Yes, he dealt and deals a lot with diaries in general, Jewish diaries and non-Jewish diaries during the war. And he argues, and I believe him, that actually Jewish diaries or diaries written by Jews are very prominent in the genre. Yes, it was really during the war in the army. It was, strictly speaking, it was forbidden to have diaries for, you know, security reasons. Yes, so if the diary is captured by the enemy and so on, but still, some people ignored this ban and actually would write, and they are very interesting and revealing diaries. Importantly, it is not something that a person would write 10, 20 years later. Yes, but, you know, our memory is not such a reliable instrument quite often. But it was, you know, the immediate reaction or something that happened today, yesterday, or something else. Yeah. And recently, actually, during this period of time between the publication of this volume and today, quite a few books came out, really publications of the diaries by mainly Jewish officers, because it would come by officers, because an officer usually was better educated, and quite often an officer wasn't necessarily the entire time in the trenches. Yes. So there was more, the situation was quieter, let's put it like this. So diaries of officers, there are diaries of women officers, yes, who were interpreters during the war, doctors during the war, or in other capacities. Yeah. So it is a very important source of information for historian.
Can you tell us about the publication Einigkeit, the newspaper of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee? Can you contextualize it for us?
During the war, there was established such a body, Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee in Moscow. It was at that time, it was outside Moscow, actually, physically, when it was first established. But afterwards, they were based in Moscow, and they were allowed to publish a Yiddish newspaper, Einigkeit, that means unity, Yes, because at that time the title itself is very important, because the Jewish this in the Soviet ideology, unity of Jews worldwide was not recognized. The whole idea of a worldwide Jewish nation was seen as wrong. It was bourgeois, Zionist, whatever. Yes, so to the according to the official guidelines, there were Soviet Jews, there were American Jews, there were French Jews, and so on. But there was no worldwide Jewry. But during the war, only during the war, it was allowed to stress unity of various Jews and Jews from various countries. Therefore, the title Einigkeit as unity. It was a newspaper that was published. Usually, the circulation was 10,000 copies. It wasn't a daily. It was initially once every 10 days, and afterwards they were allowed to publish as a weekly. 10,000 copies, about 1,500 copies would go abroad. So it was really read by a very small number of Jews compared to the entire Jewish population. And it published various stuff, you know, translations from Russian, official, you know, news, published not translation of various cultural or not cultural news, and also poetry, some prose stories. So it was literature as well was present in Einigkeit. And this newspaper, it was established in 1942. I don't remember exactly the day, but I remember the day of its last issue. It was November 20th, I believe, 1948. So during this period of time, it was published. And there was a sister publication for a while in New York, also called Einigkeit. And they would use some material from Moscow, from the Moscow newspaper, reprinting it, but also their own stuff. I remember that many years ago, I had no idea about the existence of this American sister publication, and I ordered Einigkeit at the New York Public Library, and suddenly I received something else that I didn't expect to get. Yeah, this is how this information came to me. Yes,
that's funny. Yeah. I want to just add that for the literary researcher, Einigkeit is a kind of untapped resource, because the prominent writers that we know that were famously killed, 1952, Bergelson, Hofstein, many others, published versions of work that they later refined and transformed and published in a different version later. So one of the most important Holocaust pieces of not of fiction that I think is still neglected is a story called An Aedis, or A Witness, by David Bergelson. And he published several early versions of it in Einigkeit, one of which was called Schreibendick, or Writing. And the story is about people writing down testimony. And you can also see testimony, actual historical testimony from a Jew, and the ways that Bergelson transformed this testimony into a short, and made it a part of a story. In other words, a Jew gives an oral history. This is what the Germans did to me. This is what happened. Bergelson writes it up as a piece of a story, and he calls the story Writing. And then later he changes it again, and he publishes a story called An Aedis, which is going to be in this book of translated stories called In the Shadow of the Holocaust. So it's a laboratory of Soviet Jewish writers' creativity through the experience of World War II, because you see different iterations of the same themes.
And actually, each story or each material published in Einigkeit also had an original version, yes.
Yes.
Something I have, it is a pure coincidence that I have on my desk. This is this hard disk with a copy of the archive of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee and also of the newspaper Einikeit. So you see the manuscripts, how they manipulated and how they doctored and how they changed or whatever. So in Yiddish it was called, I remember from my experience at the Yiddish journal, it was called an Ur Original. So pre-original.
To what degree was censorship imposed on Soviet Jewish writing and writers? What could they say? What could they not say? What kinds of consequences would they experience if they said things or wrote things that they should not have?
It's a question, it's a topic for a book, not for a short. It is really everything would pass through the filter of censorship, and even after this filter and published after the filter, a couple of years later, the writer could be accused of publishing something nationalist, something questionably Soviet or simply anti-Soviet, and so on and so forth. So this is difficult stuff.
Yeah, and it wasn't limited to Jews, of course. Anybody publishing anything was subject to censorship.
I usually illustrate it by the fact that when I was appointed this managing editor, I was entitled to have a business card. Yes.
Wow.
And in order to print a business card, it carried very sensitive information: my name, telephone, in two languages, on one side Yiddish, on another side in Russian. I couldn't print it, or the printing shop couldn't start printing it without a signature of a censor. So even a business card had to pass censorship.
You still have it?
I have somewhere.
I'd love to see it.
Maybe in Oxford, maybe not here.
Okay.
In what ways did female Jewish writers in the Soviet Union express themselves differently than male writers? Can you compare and contrast? Can you comment on the importance of gender in Soviet Jewish writing and literature?
It's a topic for another book. Yeah. Mm. Yes. I am writing now actually a chapter for the book that I'm writing now. It is a chapter about women writers, Soviet women writers. And their number was not huge. Unfortunately, but they were very interesting writers, very interesting writers. In terms of the expression, any human being expresses in a different way. And of course, it is the expression is also gender related. There was maybe actually statistically more poets than prose writers everywhere. If we take generally Yiddish literature in the United States, in Poland, and poets among women writers, poets dominated romantic poetry or not romantic poetry. So, in what way it was different? Yeah, it is. It depended on the authors. Yes,
I think. So one of the prominent examples I discuss in my 2011 book, Music from a Speeding Train, Shira Gorshman. I mean, her stories about going back to destroyed shtetls, hearing, seeing the silence on the streets, sort of hearing this kind of ghostly screaming voices. I think her stories are not that different from male writers who also use the genre, the travelogue, going back to the shtetl. So Shmuel Gardon's stories and Shira Gorshman's stories of post-war experience and memory are probably comparable. But in general, I would say that women writers, I mean, just like male writers, filter the historical event through the personal experience. I mean, the tendency to avoid the prophetic voice, I think, is probably higher among some women writers than men writers, but I don't think it's completely absent either.
Yeah, of course, but you can find something in poetry written by a woman that you don't find in poetry written by a man. I'm on my table a poem that, I love you, but you have a wife, And I miss you. Of course, there are some topics. Yeah, of course, it could be a different way. A man would write, "I love you, but you have a husband." Yes, but in any case, there are something very specific topics. Of course,
how was the Babi Yar massacre remembered among Soviet Jewish writers? Can you elaborate on its meaning and significance to them?
Well, you know, it wasn't an absolutely unique event. I mean, in scale, perhaps, but there were many ravines. You know, Yar means ravine. There were many of them. Many massacres happened in ravines. The reason that Babi Yar comes to such prominence is this famous poem by Yevtushenko that says there are no monuments. And so those who do research on Soviet Yiddish writing find that there's plenty of verbal monuments to Babi Yar, that there were other poets and writers. For example, Itzik Kipnis wrote a series of short, very simple stories in Yiddish about making these kind of pilgrimage trips to Babi Yar, getting off the bus and walking like they walked to Babi Yar. Der Nister wrote about Babi Yar. Many Soviet Jewish writers memorialize these events. And so I think the name is the most prominent name in the Western imagination of the Soviet Jewish Holocaust, but it doesn't really have the same meaning. Not that it wasn't important, but there are many, you know, many ravines and many killing sites that people like Panar and other places. So, but Soviet Jewish writers like Kipnis and Der Nister and others wrote in Yiddish about Babi Yar. So did Vasily Grossman.
And I believe that Arkady Zeltsev is one of the contributors
Yes.
Yeah. And so Arkady later, once again, we're speaking about later, he published a book on, he collected the information about the memorials, Holocaust memorials in the Soviet Union. He published it in English, and I received a month ago as a gift the Russian version, a bit improved, yes, and revised. He actually, if I'm not wrong, he found 750, I believe, monuments, 750 monuments. And from my recollections of growing up in all this conversation about the Holocaust, Babi Yar didn't play the central role. I'm sure it played the central role in the families living among those who lived in Kyiv.
Right.
But I didn't live in Kyiv. Yes, I lived in Ukraine, but a different place. And I don't remember Babi Yar was even mentioned. Yes, of course, the prominence and importance of Babi Yar was became really clear thanks to Yevtushenko's poem and thanks to Kuznetsov's story or whatever. It's certainly not a novel. I don't know how to call it. Long story, yes, on Babi Yar or something, and other writings. But in general, people remembered and visited, and this pilgrimage, if Kipnis was about this pilgrimage to Babi Yar, then in other places it was a pilgrimage to a local monument, or maybe not local monument, people lived all over the Soviet Union, but quite often on the Victory Day, that was May the 9th, and it was importantly after 1965, it was a day off. So it made it possible to travel, yes, from one place to another, and people would come to the place where their relatives, where friends were murdered during the war, not to Babi Yar, but to a specific place. But now I read once, time and again, that Babi Yar was the most important symbol of the Holocaust in the Soviet Union. I'm not sure. Nowadays, maybe here in Brighton Beach, 500 yards from the place where I am sitting now, there's a place called Babi Yar. And it's a playground for children, yes, that is in this Babi Yar. Yeah. So this is what you could be, because this is important in any way.
So it goes to the point that the Holocaust as a kind of institution in memory and representation in the West is different from the Nazi genocide of Jews in Soviet Jewish memory and representation. That's an important point of our book and many scholarly works on this subject. They're not the same entities.
What is your book's contribution to the history of the Holocaust and to Holocaust studies?
I don't know. I can maybe invent an answer, but I'm not sure. It is another aspect. Yeah, and some information and like any book, yeah, that comes out on this topic, it's another, you know, you're building a house, yes, or an edifice. It's a brick after a brick, yes, and each brick plays a role, yeah, because it is higher, it is stronger, and then so on. So each book is awesome. It makes the whole edifice, yeah, higher and stronger. I hope so. Yeah. So.
I mean, I think that the point of this book and other books is fairly straightforward, that the representation and memorialization of victims of Nazi genocide in the Soviet Union comes with other layers. And the other layer that we examine in this book is the fighting of the war and the participation in the sense of victory and triumph that is not usually, you know, a part of Holocaust remembrance in the West. So people were proud to have fought on the front lines, to have been officers, to have won medals, to have achieved that victory. So victory and memorialization simultaneously, I think that would be the in a nutshell, the contribution to the historiography of the Holocaust, and also that there was this form of memorialization and representation in film, literature, newspaper accounts, essays, and so forth. That people generally who study the Holocaust from the German, Polish, French perspective don't know about.
Yeah, there is a conception, or to be precise, misconception, yeah, that in the Soviet Union, anything that had to do with the Holocaust was suppressed. Many things were suppressed in the Soviet Union, yes, including, but still it is a huge number of writings, of many things. And every time I come across a new book and a new something here on the Holocaust. So the question is to revive it, yes, to include it into the edifice, yes.
What new perspectives does the book provide regarding Ilya Ehrenberg and his importance and legacy?
First of all, it provides, as far as I remember, it is in this book, that Ehrenberg was essentially the first, it seems as the first, who spelled out and put it in writing, the figure 6 million.
Yeah, that's from Julio Juanito. That's from a novel he published in the 20s, right?
No, it is really, I believe in November, there's this article by, what is his name? Rubinstein, yes.
No, but also in the novel, there is a novel that Ilya Ehrenberg wrote way before the Holocaust, in which he predicted, yeah, and he used the number 6 million just by the footnote.
Yeah,
the Jews were not tolerated in Europe.
It is before. But during the war, if we come to the war, he was apparently the first who in the fall of 1944 published, it was his newspaper, his hundreds and hundreds of his articles. In one of his articles, he mentioned the 6 million. In the United States, the 6 million was for the first time, there was an article in the New York Times, I believe it was in February 1945. It was, the article was called 6 million something, yes. So I don't know whether the person who mentioned the 6 million in the United States, his name was Jacob Lischinsky, a prominent Soviet, a prominent Jewish demographer and economist, whether he took it from Ehrenbuch's article or he was knowledgeable enough to do it himself. But in any case, it was later. Ehrenbuch is, in general, he's one of the central figures for any history of the Second World War, including Jewish history or Jewish aspect of the history of the Second World War. And I believe our book somehow, you know, contributes to reminding about him. Yes, though about Ehrenbuch afterwards, books came out. A few books came out about Ehrenbuch, but our volume also somehow contributes to the story of Ehrenbuch during the Second World War.
What does your book teach us about trauma? How did Soviet Jewish writers comprehend and come to terms with trauma?
It is your.
No, I mean, you know, I'm kind of anti the theory of trauma dominating discussions of mass public violence and historical events, because trauma is a memory you suppress. You don't remember it, and it plays out in your mind afterwards in the form of various symptoms, disorders that you explode at a moment that seems unrelated to anything in your violent past. These writers were confronted with ongoing violence and immediate traces of violence, homes, family members, objects and artifacts, lives destroyed, children, babies murdered. I mean, to quote Ilya Ehrenberg, I saw it. They saw it. They didn't suppress it. So our book and most of my work and Gennady's work and many people are, they didn't suppress it. They saw it and they wrote about it and they expressed it. I mean, we didn't talk about it in this book, but Peretz Markish wrote, I don't know, I think it was 2,000 line poem called Milchoma, the War, and it's about the slaughter of Jews. So I don't think it's a question of trauma. I think it's a question of confronting violence, you know, in your face. It happened in your shtetl. It happened in the field outside your home. When I try to make this real to students, I live in a small college town, Champaign, in the middle of cornfields, and there's a neighboring town called Muhammad or Monticello. And I say, supposing someone told you that the enemy was in Monticello and that you should run away, what would you do? So I don't think it's really a question of trauma. I think that the question of trauma maybe comes in the 30 years afterwards, after the anti-cosmopolitan campaign and the doctor's plot and the, you know, it became very difficult then to speak. But in the 1940s, which is our period, I don't think it's a question of trauma at all.
How did you meet the contributors to this volume? What were the challenges involved in your roles as editors?
It's just regular stuff, yes. So as when you edit a volume, it is more or less the same challenge every time. The hardest one is to reject something, yeah. And the result is you reject and you lose a contact with a person, or you reject and you are still in civilized relations with a person. Yeah, this is, but also to edit, to double check, to, yes, I don't remember really serious problems. Do you remember? No, it was.
I mean, this was like the usual suspects, you know. Olga Gershwin, David Schneer, Joshua Rubinstein, Adia Gudnitsky, Marat Greenberg, you and me. I mean, these are
professional people.
Who worked together as V. Gittleman. These are people we already knew and worked together and were familiar with. So it wasn't difficult to come up with names or to like track them down or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Who did you prepare this book for? Who Who do you consider the ideal reader and the imagined audience? Who were you trying to reach in preparing this book?
You know, I was surprised once. There's such a website, WorldCat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's somehow accumulation of the information from various libraries. Not all the libraries of the entire world, but usually academic libraries or somehow significant libraries. And once I was looking for something, and suddenly I realized a figure comes up that this book is in 1,000 libraries. And I was surprised because this is an academic book. Usually I know that all other titles that I am involved in or written by me, if it's 300 copies, it's a lot. It's a lot. It is real success because we are not, we are not really writing something called bestsellers. Yeah, but it means that what we did, I mean, not only Harriet and my involvement, but all the contributors, it found an echo. Yes, so yeah, somehow we weren't involved in marketing, and I can't say that Academic Studies Press is a wonderful marketing enterprise. Yes, but apparently there was a void. Yes, and it filled it somehow it somehow put this void. Yes, at least. Partly, it stopped being an empty place here. This is, who are the readers? And actually, not all the libraries. I just, you know, it's I checked some of the libraries. Not all of them were academic libraries or just communal libraries or something. Also, apparently addressing the general reader, and I was happy to see it here. That is what it was, a combination of professional and just lay reader here.
What does this volume teach us about anti-Semitism?
Did we discuss it in the volume? I don't believe we discussed it. Because do you know, I remember very well, Harriet mentioned this, veterans and so on. And one of the questions that was discussed at the time from the audience, I believe. Do you remember anti-Semitism when you were in fighting in the army? And somehow it was a group of veterans. I don't remember how many people. It wasn't huge, but not two, and maybe eight, seven. I'm inventing a figure here. But all of them answered, no. We were fighting, and fighting was the most important thing, and so on. And of course, the issue of anti-Semitism is very serious during the Second World War. It is a separate issue, but I don't believe we discussed it in our book. Now I recall, in one of the translations, Mikhail Roms' memoirs, yes, and I remember that it starts. I don't remember exactly, but more or less paraphrasing. Until 1941, do you have it here? Yeah. Until 1941, we lived without anti-Semitism. And somehow we managed to, yeah, how it is.
One second. Not Rybakov, it's Rom, right?
Rom, yes.
Oh, okay.
Mikhail Rom was a prominent Soviet film director. Yes.
I am not. Letter to Stalin. Okay, wait. Until 1943, as we know, we had no anti-Semitism, comrades. Somehow we managed without.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the big, you know, there was, the book is about fighting World War II, so the big anti-Semite is Hitler. To some far less extent is this book about the other big anti-Semite, Stalin. This is mostly about Hitler and Judeo-Bolshevism, which we discussed, was, you know, the alleged Judeo-Bolshevik specter that was going to destroy Europe is a big part of the Hitler motivation. We briefly discussed, like, you know, the fact that Jews were accused of not being at the front. But really, the prominent theme of this book is not anti-Semitism as such.
How does your book recontextualize the work and reputation of Boris Slutsky?
I know that his reputation is, I don't, everyone is trying to to shake his reputation. Yeah, there are some interesting episodes in his life. Yeah, that maybe are not so nice. Yeah, but otherwise he was an excellent poet. He was a soldier. So I believe what is important about Slutsky that in our case that he left an important text, and we published this text here.
Right. I mean, the person to talk to about Slutsky is Marat Grinberg, who has the article of a chapter in the book. I mean, he's the one that's written the most about, in English, about the Jewish dimensions of Boris Slutsky's poetry.
Why is the history of Soviet Jewish writers important in the year 2023? What does the history of Soviet Jews during World War II teach us in the year 2023?
You know, I am either old or I was born being skeptical. I don't believe that history is a teacher. I don't believe that history teaches. History gives an example. History gives the information. History gives food for thought, for thinking. But as a teacher, you know, we know that how many people repeat something that any person who knows history and who uses history as a sort of wisdom is not supposed to do. So this is my answer. I don't believe it. And I keep telling this my students that don't try to find it as a teaching. Yes. Well, look at this as the information, intellectual in information, whatever.
As we bring today's dialogue to a close, can you kindly tell us about what you've been working on since this book came out? Can you tell us about some of your subsequent work?
Try to be quick. In 2019, I published a book on David Bergelson called David Bergelson's Strange New World, and he very prominently wrote about the Holocaust. I have a book coming out called As the Dust of the Earth, The Literature of Abandonment in Revolutionary Russia and Ukraine, and it's about the pogroms of the Russian Civil War era. Gennady and I co-edited a book that's out already called Building Modern Jewish Culture, the Kyiv Kulturliga. And I think I'm working on a book of translations with Sasha Senderovich directly related to the material of this book called In the Shadow of the Holocaust.
Thank you, Eric.
A few books, yes, that I published during this period. I published a book, Transatlantic Russian Jewishness, and it's mainly about the New York Yiddish newspaper, the Forwards, yes. I also published recently a book came out beginning of this year on Birobidzhan, history of Birobidzhan. But the end of 2022, two volumes came out. It's from a Soviet project that I'm also one of the editors of all the volumes. But two volumes came out. One volume is I wrote about the period in Soviet Jewish history after Stalin. It's 1953-1967. And the volume came out, it has four authors. It's about, again, Soviet Jewish history during the Second World War. So it is a direct echo, yes, of the book we just discussed. At the moment, I'm writing a book that I hope to finish by December that is called Yiddish Literature Under Surveillance. You mentioned censorship, but in this case, it is more than censorship. It is focuses mainly on the repressions about Yiddish writers who ended up in the hands of the Soviet secret police. Some of them were executed, some of them survived, but spent many years in labor camps. So this is what I'm working.
Thank you for sharing. As we end today's dialogue, I am your host on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast, Ari Barbalat. Today, I've been in dialogue with Harriet Morav and Gennady Estreich regarding their edited volume, Soviet Jews in World War II, Fighting, Witnessing, Remembering, published in Boston by Academic Studies Press in 2014. Gennady Estreich is professor in the Skirbel Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies at New York University. Harriet Morav is a Center for Advanced Study professor. Catherine and Bruce Bastien, professor of Global and Transnational Studies, a member of the Slavic Languages and Literatures Department and interim director of the Department of Comparative and World Literature at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And once again, yeah. Shana tova.
Shana tova. Thank you.